You're listening to the Creative Processes interview with writer, philosopher, and scholar, Patrick Healy. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. Where did your fascination with the beauty, the music of language begin? Can you trace it back?
Well, I think that something in the book has to do with memory. But it isn't just memory relating to place. It's also memory relating to sounds or to phrases. So I was very fascinated as a child as to why, when you were learning the alphabet, you were shown a picture of a donkey. You know, D is for donkey or G is for goose. And it fascinated me that you could recognize from a drawing an animal you had seen, but also an animal you hadn't seen. So that if you showed a child of 3 or 4 a book of dinosaurs, they still knew there were animals, even though they'd never seen these animals, because the association of an actual alphabet letter with a picture and later then with a sound became very fascinating. And at the same time, you were learning to write. And as you may remember, one of the biggest achievements when you're about 3 or 4 in writing is that you write your own name, and that there's a certain, it's even before you can keep a secret from your mother. You have this secret moment when you can write out your name as whatever it is. And I think that these were kind of, if you like, the memories of where you begin to feel that you've started to live, that this is you. This is not other people calling you, you. This is you writing yourself in a movement of the hand with a pen. Usually it had a nib. You often talked about the nib getting sprained, and you had to dip it into a small white enamel inkwell, as it was called, which was inserted into the top of the desk, which had a slanting cover on it. And you dipped the pen in and you wrote in a line jotter book your name. And you would write it out maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 times. And at that stage, a teacher, this was in what was called baby infants at the age of 4, not high infants. Miss O'Carroll was the teacher. And if you wrote very well, you were given a gold star. So there was some, if you like, it's setting you on a kind of path where you're meant to achieve things, where you're supposed to be doing, you get rewarded, you write your name. And the repetition of this was like you say to yourself, you know, I am this. I am what I write. It opens with, I mean, what I suppose for an Irish book is a rather unusual situation. It is somebody called the Count Taff, who is an Irish Austro aristocrat who lives in the local area. And he's teaching this young boy Japanese whilst he's making a consomme. But the point about the mix of the ingredients is he's making a consomme. He's not making a stew. And the word satura or satar actually comes from a stew where you put a lot of ingredients together. But the process here is to take a lot of ingredients and to distill it down. So the distillation process is almost like an alchemical process. It's about the way in which through the filters of the language being learned and through the child's listening, whereby he takes the phrase sore, sore, he knows that that's the word sure, sure in English pronunciation. So he's using other language to remember words in language. And in the space between, of course, he's beginning to develop actually a kind of satire. He's becoming humorously dislocated from the very language in which he's becoming fluent. And this parallels the way in which his own naming is a double naming, because what is discovered in the book much, much later, somebody is sitting in what is presumably Port Tran, which was called a mental hospital. And in those days, you could be institutionalized, was the phrase used. But it wasn't always that people were locked up for, you know, there were sort of day, you could be let out, or you could go in for a while and come out, or there were all kinds of different levels of engagement in the institution itself in the local area. And it was half spoken about, it was half mentioned, it was considered slightly shameful. Somehow, an older version of what looks like a narrator seems to be talking about the fact that there was a double name due to the fact that this is a foster family and is not the child's biological mother, and so on and so forth. but that according to the custom, the official name of the birth cert is kept in the school register, and he has the family name. So he has a double name problem, a little bit like the problem of a double language, of there being Irish and English. There's two names, there's two languages, and there's constant movement in between both of these, so that you are both, and you are neither one nor the other. I think one Irish writer once said, you don't finish books, they abandon you. John McGahan, I think it was, I'm not quoting him exactly, but it's that idea. At a certain point, you have to say Schluss, that's it, or aus. You have to get out of it in some way. Because you can see that even though there are no great events occurring in the book, or there's no massive narration being piled up sequentially, it's a kind of, it's both episodic and you don't know what's coming next. Because voices just suddenly enter, and they're not given double quote marks. You almost have no single quote marks. You get to know the voices because of how the characters earlier have been introduced. So you know this is something from the parish priest, or from Father O'Brien, or from Molly Eustace, or from Mrs. Marmion, or the various named people who are coming in and out of the book, who have certain interests, comments, Mr. Dunn on the flower, on the usage of for the flower show, the foster mother herself, who doesn't actually say very much within the book, but you get quite a lot of movement now, not only between the different language worlds, but also between the characters, because the characters are mostly real names of people, but on the other hand, some of them are inventors. So there is again a play of invention and reality. So what I'm going to do is this. I've now opened a page. And okay, Herr Ole Ilan Angle, noble Ireland, Isle of Angels. Didn't the Pope call two slave boys in Rome the same, Angeli? Maybe it was all one Dwangeli. We are the Dwanglies. The Pritto Britto, Angle Langle, Brilla, men are happy, 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 thus committing adultery. You might as well rave there as in bed. Have you ever heard of a prey of horses? Indeed, an ounce of gold for every nose in Ireland. That was the Fomorian tribute. If she didn't have to mind Jane, she would have been an archaeologist. Swears by the O'Rahilly and is reading it constantly. Maybe that's why they say you end up paying through the nose. You're having me on, pull the other. August Ingi Doctor Gokshroneren, an ounce of gold for every nose in Ireland. Then there is, that is there in the book Finton then say, it will belong to clerics to the end of time. No keeping them fed. I tell you, there are bells and angels all right, but don't worry. On the last day, all will be sorted out, and Periwinkle Tom will lead a chorus. Oh, keep from the lake where 900 of the youth of Ireland drowned, and from the river where the king's daughter was swept away. He will prophesy in the lake of no birds and make offerings like Hannibal. We shall hear them rattle in the house of bleached bones, sing in the hall of lyres, give judgment in the house of Tours. We had only two claims. Either it was from the nobles of Spain or via the Phoenicians. It's only with the old English, who are the new Irish, that the claims of the Celtic came about. You can thank Father Keating for that. I can't make head nor tail of this. What are you going on about? Sealy, that is Seal Island, a wild bluff out there and speaking with a loud voice but without an evil word. Gun Gotto. Morgon Druck Fuckle. After the storm, masses of seaweed driven into the shore, the perchman holds up the seaweed with his pole when it arrives, and then it has to be moved before the next tide. But if there is not much, the weed is divided into pennies, yes, pinyin, and the land for the manure into rigs and ridges. Didn't you hear tell of that before? I might have. The fire is smouldering, it's smoured by the Son of Mary. There is an angel in the door by the door of every house. The cawing and crowing sounds never end under those. You are right. I must remember them. Tie a knot there and I'll have it again. So there you have, of course, the whole issues of the different languages interplaying with each other, little scraps of Irish languages, idioms. I have stories that are being told historically about how Ireland actually comes about as an idea as to where the Irish come from. So a lot of these kind of debates are just taking place, you know, in day-to-day conversation. and then they trail off. People start something, they trail off. They might come back to it later. That phenomenon of, you know, speaking over each other, telling tales that are known, not known, I found always very interesting in Ireland. It was literally like a radio, you know, radio kept on all day in the kitchen. You would come in and out, and you would hear certain things, and you'd have to work out the context and the conversation and the speakers. In some way, one of the big personalities in the book is just a radio that's playing, and that some of these conversations are not actually taking place between characters in real time. They're just snippets that have been overheard on radios.
The open transmission, and it is a sense that you do get a lot in Ireland. If you travel around and you might have just met somebody and they're talking to you like you knew them for years, yeah, and then they're referring to old bits of history, your man who moved down the road, and you just have to be on your toes and kind of like decipher this archaeology. So I do like that, the idea of it's a radio. And I sometimes wondered, was it like ghosts? Because you kind of hinted that at the end, like, you know, as it goes back to the beginning. So I really like that. And I wondered, did you write it chronological? You know, you opened there and in the middle. Do you want to read some more?
She stood at the jamb of the door. She did nothing. Musty sighed to her, attached root, crabbed, gibbing. They called her a hex, preparing meals for the hens, selling eggs by the dozen. An old horse with a hollow back, fat as a goose. Twilight. Smell of Old Spice aftershave, strutting and straddle of bantam cocks. An unlikely pair, a fox, an eagle, hairy, lair, littered in a brake at the foot of a tree on which the eagle alighted to survey his prey. Awful racket. And a certain day, the fox being away, let me guess, the eagle swooped down at the cubs and took them to feed the eaglets. Fox could only curse on return. The nestlings. Soon after, eagle swooped down an altar where meat for the sacrifice was being burnt on a brand like a stick. And lo and behold, it set fire to the nest. The eaglets fell to the ground, and the fox ate them in the very sight of the eagle. Oh, to hear again the homing rook, scone of a fat cabbage, peels of potatoes left in a white enamel bucket with a wooden wire handle, and to think of her, she said, crumpled in piety, a silver sixpence with a greyhound. Now, if you can bend the iron bar in the fellow of that wheel. She coughed and rasped, bowing, stooping, holding a pitcher of milk, a pail of milk, and Periwinkle Tom with his sack of periwinkles, the milk settling in the pitcher, yellow the cream hue as the cream settled. Leave her, and nothing of the stammer word for heartburn, pharmacopoeia. We must rack the flower beds with seaweed and ask for help from Periwinkle Tom. Doncy, dill, dingle and dung, dingle, doncy, dung and dale. Oh, the doncy fellow called a dingle a dale and said it's yellow. Some people said we were very influenced by Joyce. And I said, well, I mean, Joyce influences everything ever afterwards, of course, as a writer. But this is not set in the city. This is not among urban intellectuals. This is not in sort of the modern setting of an advertising canvasser and sophisticated people having adulterous affairs and so on. This is actually set in the countryside, and you know, where the intelligentsia, if you like, is the local vet, the chemist, the priests, the school teacher, and that there is a very almost strong relationship to them as keepers of collective memory. People are always kind of looking out. So this greyhound on the sixpence is an actual coinage of the time, a rail, which probably comes from the Spanish real, which comes up in the book. That's discussed at quite some length. So all kinds of tiny fragments of material culture are given the same weight as verbal play between characters, and the verbal play between characters is given the same weight as snatches from a radio. And meanwhile, this is layered between different, if you like, tiers of memory, because we know from the beginning of the book that there's somebody learning Japanese, that this is actually the memory of a writer who has just died in Amsterdam, which an editor has started to work on. And we're given the first part of what would have been his book. But as the editor moves through the pages, because it's a very large manuscript, He loses control of the pages because he lets them fall on the ground and they haven't been numbered. So then episodes are beginning to hop in and out, and he has to occasionally make either comments or get help with it. And eventually it looks like it's kind of stabilizing itself, but only at about page 60, it starts to stabilize. Then you get these kind of episodic in and out. And there, it's, I suppose, the technique is more like in cinema, because you never know, actually, no matter how much you know in a film, you could never say, this is what the next scene is going to show. It's like when we speak. You can never say, this is the next sentence I'm going to speak. You can't do it. That's, yeah. That process where we generate and transmit language because we are spoken to or we are named and we are engaged constantly in this naming and speaking as if we're trying to find out something, whereas in fact, we're perhaps just enjoying ourselves, like Beckett says, like with an itch. You know, this is just what we have to do because we have a brain and we just need to talk to find things out, to say things. And I think that's also part of what's in this book. I try to get as close to those processes as I can. And so yeah. I think it's just that. I mean, when we're talking about different literature, writing, anything, it's all about being able to imagine different ways of living and doing things. You know, I'm living on the margins and I was thinking about the word margin, and then it struck me that margins were where the first little figures, like troubadour figures in medieval manuscripts, they would draw them. And they were then considered outside the margin. So that's where you get outsider art. In other words, and that's a term almost of abuse, because it's like saying, oh, there's only one way to be an artist, and you've got to go to an art school, and you've got to go then and have a gallery, and then you have to have your own studio and atelier, because if not, and I think, what is this? This is a complete concoction. You know, the long history of art is over 15,000, 20,000, 45,000, 35,000 years of art. So it's been going on for so. This is our species behavior. We make art. There's no external mystery to this. Do you know what I mean? It's not some kind of extra consciousness. Yeah, we're art-making beings.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.